Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and today's visit with Ken Vincent. His buddies in the 3rd Armored Division in World War II called him Vince. In Waterford, Wisconsin, they know him now as Kenny. We heard about his exploits with the accordion as a young boy, how he enlisted in the Army shortly after the attack on Pearl Harbor. And when we left off, he was in England. And I'm sure, Kenny, that you guys were starting to hear some rumblings about heading across the channel to invade German-held France.
First of all, we knew that Eisenhower was working on a thin little window of opportunity to make this invasion. We were already brought down into the, we call them cattle yards. They were nothing more than long, long fenced-in yards, devoid of anything but at one end, a portable kitchen, another end, porta-potties, and all you did was eat and sleep. Now, we couldn't figure out for the life of us. We're an armored division, tanks mainly, and armored infantry. All the word armor in relation to the infantry means that where the tanks went, they went.
Right.
And vice versa. Because those tanks, see, I had my basic training back at Camp Polk in a tank outfit. And believe me, those things are blind. When you're inside, you've got the little rectangular slots you can look through, but they're blind for all practical purposes.
But so while you're still there, you talked about the cattle yards. Did you guys get a report back about what had happened on June 6th?
On the afternoon of the 5th, we loaded up onto the LC.
Is it an LST, maybe? Landing ship tank?
Yeah, landing ship tank.
Okay.
And we're just sitting there. And we were told that we had to be on the decks. We couldn't be down in the holds of the boat at all. We had to have our life jackets on. And we couldn't figure out why in the world we'd even be loaded like that, because no beachhead at that point in time was going to be large enough to handle an armored division. Then the night of the 5th, the paratroopers went over. They were so low, you had the feeling that you could almost reach up and touch them.
So you saw the planes heading over? The saw the C-47s?
The C-47s.
Towing gliders.
The gliders over.
You saw them take off.
Yeah.
But you're still on this ship.
Yeah. We couldn't see anything on the other side except a little pinkish, orangish glow, maybe is the word to use, because the paratroopers that had already landed had blown up things. There were fires going on over there, and what we saw were buildings burning from a distance, you know. Mm-hmm. But all we could see would be just a faint little line of pinkish orange, because we're looking at something like 18 to 20 miles.
Yeah, so you're still just right off the coast of England.
Yeah.
But on a ship prepared to be part of.
So then they have us get off in the dopey cattle yards again. Then we actually landed in Normandy, I want to say the 16th or maybe even the 17th. It was a nice clear day. We had no opposition whatsoever. Two German planes came over, and as soon as they saw all the ships beneath them, they started to climb like crazy. They dropped their bombs just to get rid of their loads so they could be lighter and have a better chance of getting back home. I never did see them hit with all the anti-aircraft that went up after them.
Well, I want to know what you saw when you got to Normandy, but I also wonder, have you ever been able to piece together why you guys didn't go over with the invasion force, why you were all loaded and ready to go, but were held back?
Because maybe someone realized an armored division takes room, elbow room. That beachhead that was established at first wasn't going to handle the division. And then when we went over, they had, by that time, had bulldozed all the garbage out of the way, and they had swaths leading up into the interior. Mm-hmm. And then we were guided into our jump-off point into some real deep woods, and we were told to dig foxholes and dig them good and deep.
And sorry for slowing you down here. I want to go back one more time to June 5th. As you're loading that ship, have you ever thought, what would have happened to me if we did go over, if we hadn't been held back? Because you were all loaded, ready to go. Do you think you'd be here sitting with me if you had had to go over then?
You know, the emotion that I had most of the time, now remember, I'm 22, was This is a big experience. I wasn't thinking about death. Death didn't hit me in the face until we jumped off on our first campaign. And what brought it to mind so was that morning, early in the morning, right after the sun was up, everybody complained about the air vibrating in their ears so, and a sound coming from someplace. We didn't have any engines or motors running or anything like that. Nobody could figure it out. Then one guy said, "Hey, look it up there." And he's pointing up, and between the clouds, you could see thousands of bombers, and they were dropping their bomb loads. Ahead of us, they'd taken a section of land so many miles wide by so many miles deep. When the lead bomber of each squadron would get to a certain point, it had to discharge its red flare. We saw oodles of red flares, and that meant that squadron was simply to get rid of its load. Don't worry about hitting anything. Hit an empty highway, hit a river, hit a lake, hit anything. Don't worry about it. That's what was happening. Well, one of the squadrons dropped its flare a little too soon. See, at that point in time, the 29th and 30th Infantry Divisions were holding the line. One of the battalions got clobbered by that bomb load.
American bombs.
American bombs.
So you saw American bombs kill American troops.
Ooh. As far as the eye could see, were dead GIs. Most of them were in pieces. Some of them looked like they got tired and just went to sleep. But if you took a closer look, there'd be blood coming out of their ears or out of their noses. The concussion got them.
Their bodies weren't torn apart, but the concussion just killed
that's
them from
right.
the inside.
And that's where we lost our first American general, a fellow by the name of McNair.
Yeah.
He came up. There was a problem of some kind that he wasn't satisfied with, so he came up and he got under that barrage.
That was July 25th of 44 that he was killed in his foxhole near St. Lo, and the estimate afterwards was that 77 American bombers dropped their bombs short of where they were supposed to and decimated the American lines. And it's been said that General Eisenhower was so upset about that that he instructed his generals never to use the heavy bombers in that tactical of fashion, because it just wasn't going to be precise enough. But you saw that devastation firsthand.
Oh, yeah.
But give us a sense of what you had to do as an 81-millimeter gunner. You guys are, about five football fields back from the front line?
Yeah. First of all, a mortar generally is the most hated weapon on the battlefield. The Germans hated us above all else. We hated their mortars. Because with artillery, as an example, you can hear the stuff come in. You can hear your own going out. You know what caliber the stuff that's coming in is. But you've got a chance to hit the bottom of your hole. We'd work with the 1st Battalion over here. Our 3rd Battalion was always over on our left. And when we would meet, we'd have to hold until the infantry cleared out that pocket.
Right.
That might be 2-3 days. Well, we'd have our holes dug as close to our guns as we could, so we could just drop down into the hole when things start coming in on us, because that shrapnel can make hamburger out of a man in a split second, can cut him absolutely right in half.
But with the mortar, you don't know when it's coming or where it's coming from.
The first thing you're going to hear is that awful screech when it's on top of you. I've been sitting on the edge of my foxhole with my feet on the bottom, and they started dropping in on us, and I wouldn't have a chance to hit the bottom of my hole when they were blowing.
It's how little warning you have.
Yeah.
So how close did they come to you? Oh,
well, in our next squad, the 1st squad was always over here on our right. One of those mortar rounds landed right in the hole on top of a guy. Well, obviously, he never knew it hit him, of course, but I think someplace in the ether, he's still flying. Just indescribable.
Just blew him right out of the hole.
Oh, and blew the hole into nothing.
Yeah.
When I said that shrapnel can cut a guy right in half, I don't like to go into all these details, but I was serving that day as the number 2 gunner. I was the guy that would drop the round down the tube, kneeling on my right knee, and I would do this so that when that bugger blew, I wouldn't get my fool head blown off.
So you're dropping it in and you're ducking your head away at the same time.
Yeah.
Right.
After this barrage ended, I get a crawl back up to my spot, and my number three man had the round already. He gave it to me, or maybe he threw it to me, because we got to the place where we'd actually toss them.
Because you're trying to get as many off as fast as you can.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
And I look over on the other side of the tube and see this tube is no bigger round in diameter than that, and it's down to the base plate, stands up about so high.
About 3 feet.
And where's my number one man? He's laying over in two pieces. A shell had landed, I don't know how many yards, not many yards away from us. I remember the concussion blew me backwards. My back folded backwards.
Inside out.
Yeah, inside out. My feet were in the bottom of the hole, and my back was on the edge. For a while, I thought I broke my back. I remember the guy, his mouth was going. He was trying to say something. That was it. He bled out.
And he was 3, 4, 5 feet away from you?
Oh, yeah.
Just on the other side of the mortar?
Just on the other side of the mortar. No more than 3 feet, 4 feet at the most.
Wow. How does a 22-year-old kid handle this? When you see a guy doing the exact same thing you're doing get disintegrated by a mortar coming on top of him, the guy right next to you, a few feet away, gets cut in half. And these are just two examples out of months and months and months of combat. How do you deal with that, and how do you avoid being paralyzed by the fear that the same thing's going to happen to you?
At first, it's numbing, if that's the word. Then after a while, you find yourself forcing yourself to accept it, and you become hardened to it. I actually believe you become hardened to it. I remember that night, though, I tried to get a few winks of sleep in the bottom of my hole. I don't think I slept.
I don't think anyone would blame you. When things like that happen, you mentioned being hardened, desensitized to it over time. But are there times when you see things like that and the thought comes into your mind, what are my mom and dad going to think if this happens to me? Do you find yourself saying a prayer or holding on to something that's going to give you some kind of hope?
You've heard the expression, I'm sure, that there are no atheists in foxholes.
Yes, sir.
Well, now, in those days, I wasn't a Christian. I didn't become a Christian until after I seriously went with my wife. She became a Christian as a very little girl. She was the one that brought me to the Lord. But in those days, I wasn't. But let me tell you, I knew that there was someone more supreme than me. And I remember even having a little testament.
The military would issue a little pocket New Testament? Yeah.
I would try to read out of that. I remember laying in the bottom of my hole, praying to beat the band. Save me, Lord, you know.
Well, and you talk about that impact that your wife had on you, but again, you would have never made it home to marry her if you didn't survive all these things in Europe. And a couple questions come to mind for me. One, you talked about 3 different mortar squads in your platoon. So how many people is that total?
About 30.
About 30. Out of those 30 guys, how many of them were still in that outfit when you finished the war?
Well, we shipped out from Camp Joyce Kilmer in New Jersey for Britain. I would say there were 8 or 9, maybe 10 of us all together that shipped out from the States.
Uh-huh.
The rest were replacements. The ones that didn't make it were either bad casualties and eventually were sent back to the States or were killed.
And that's what I'm getting at. You made it through to the end, but I get the sense that the odds were against that.
The assault gun platoon was absolutely wiped out to the man.
Nobody left.
Nobody left. The reconnaissance platoon, that was wiped out. They turned over like 200% because those guys all went to motorcycle school down in basic training at Camp Polk.
Uh-huh.
Then when they were finished, they were assigned to different companies, and a lot of messages, it wasn't felt, could be safe to be sent by radio, so they used motorcycles. I remember one of the guys who was our physical combat instructor. He was what you'd call the soldier's soldier.
Uh-huh.
You would see him on a poster. Join the army, you know.
Right.
Handsome guy, built like a, I don't know what. That very first morning, his motorcycle was laying on one side of the road. He wasn't even completely off of it. He was still partly on it. A little hole drilled in his skull right below his helmet. And I remember his name even to this day. His last name was Avery. A likable guy. Oh, he was a likable guy.
One of the more than 406,000 Americans killed during World War II. Such a heavy price paid for the freedom we all enjoy. And Mr. Vincent mentioned that casualty rate of 200% for the reconnaissance platoon. That means it had to be completely replaced two times over because of deaths and injuries. The 3rd Armored Division lost more tanks in combat than any other division. It lost more than 2,500 men and had another 7,500 wounded. That's more than 10,000 Purple Hearts issued for just 231 days of combat. So many of those casualties were inflicted during the Battle of the Bulge, and we'll hear how Mr. Vincent experienced that legendary battle when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.